Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, the Lancet HIV's podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief Peter Hayward. The April issue of the journal contains a range of interesting articles, from research into the impact of COVID-19 on HIV incidence among men who have sex with men in the USA, to a review of implementation of different testing approaches to identify undiagnosed HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. But the first research article in the April issue is a report of the 96-week results of the Phase 3 FLARE study, a trial of long-acting cabotegravir for the treatment of HIV in adults. And I am absolutely delighted to be joined by the lead author of the study, Professor Chloe Orkin from Queen Mary University in London and Barts Health Trust. Hello there, Chloe.
So to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about the FLARE study and the 96-week results that are reported in this month's issue?
I'm really excited to see the results coming out. And as you mentioned, it's injectable treatment. So it's the first ever injectable treatment for HIV. And this study was a monthly treatment for people who started off on their first ever HIV treatment. So they were antiretroviral naive and they were suppressed for 20 weeks of oral treatment. And then those that were suppressed were randomized either to get monthly injections or to receive daily oral treatment. And we saw the data at week 48, which showed that the injectable treatment was non-inferior to the oral treatment. And now the 96-week data, this is confirmed once again. So the top line is that it's non-inferior to an oral treatment. There were no further cases of resistance in year two and no further cases of failure in year two. And in terms of tolerability, it was really well tolerated in terms of side effects. And in terms of injection site reactions, these were really limited in terms of duration. They last for about 3 to 7 days and then mostly go away within 3 days. Very, very few people discontinued due to the injections, which really speaks for itself. It kind of means that people voted with their feet and carried on taking the injections. And the majority of the injections were, you know, a very sort of grade one or two, so mild reactions. So in summary, I would say that the data were very good in year two with consistent findings in terms of injection site reactions, which sort of decrease over time and are mild, and, you know, good efficacy, no further resistance. So promising results for year two.
Seems like things are looking good for long-acting injectables. So it seems like we've been talking about long-acting treatment for HIV for quite a long time now. Why is such long-acting therapy seen as an important treatment goal for people living with HIV?
Yeah, it's such an important question that you ask. And I agree, we've been talking about this for such a long time, doing surveys, asking our patient community whether they want this, do they want injections, do they want implants, what do they want? And I think that there's a lot of interest in this. And I think that what I would say to start with is that HIV is in some ways very different from other illnesses in terms of the stigma that people experience. But in other ways, medically, there are some similarities. And what I would say is that in other fields, such as in contraception, such as in osteoporosis, such as in psychiatry, long-acting treatments have transformed people's outcomes, particularly those people that find it hard to take treatment. And our treatments in HIV are hard to take because they require a daily decision, a good decision-making. People have to make a daily good decision in order to carry on treatment. And that requires sort of a focus. And this can really be affected by people's life circumstances. If they're living in very unstable housing, multi-occupancy households with lots of people, they may worry about confidentiality. People, you know, who have addictions may find it difficult. People with cognitive impairment and people who feel really self-stigmatized or have been really stigmatized by communities. You know, for so many reasons, people find oral treatment to be, you know, almost like a shackle that they want to throw off and a constant reminder of infection. And I think that is really why people really want a long-term injection. They want what is possible in other specialties.
So is it right that at the moment for injectable therapies such as cabotegravir, they're administered by a care provider, so unlike the oral treatment administered by the patients themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a deep gluteal injection. So it's two injections, one into each buttock. And at the moment, that's what it is. There are some studies which are looking at other sites, potentially thigh injections. I think that, you know, at the moment, that's where it is being delivered. I think that, you know, how this is going to work is going to depend on different health systems. So the clinic is certainly an environment where this can be done. In environments where there are sort of, you know, community nursing, it could potentially be done by a nurse at home. In some countries, they'll be able to do it in pharmacies because pharmacists actually treated people for hep C, you know, in the past. Yeah. So in different systems, it's going to work differently. And I think that everyone, all of the physicians who are sort of leading on the injection that I speak to, are really, the devil is in the detail, and the detail is going to be specific to each person's sort of health economy, firstly, and also, you know, how the care is provided in terms of who is able to do this, you know, and how to manage it. It's definitely going to be a change in terms of what we normally do, because currently we're able to give people oral treatment, and in general, we're able to see people every 6 months and potentially do a viral load every 6 months or possibly every year. And this is really going to be a change because it's an increase in the frequency of hospital appointments, monitoring, and obviously staff time.
That's really interesting and almost slightly counterintuitive, that sort of longer interval between treatment means that there's a greater need for more frequent monitoring.
I mean, what I would say to that, though, is that healthcare professionals hold different views on this, depending on their health setting. And they've done some work already looking at people, healthcare providers' opinions. And what's clear, in different parts of the world, different people think that injection monthly is more feasible than others. Yeah. So in Africa and North America, they felt this was very feasible, and they're actually already doing it in Canada. It's been licensed for some time, and the Canadians are getting on with it. But in other health economies, they felt less certain. I mean, I think that the key point that I would make is it sounds like a lot of investment, but quality of life is very important. It's the fourth 90. It's what we're all striving for, not to just spend our lives measuring our life in coffee spoons, as T.S. Eliot says, but actually having a meaningful life and having the life we want to live, the quality of life. And that's what we want to give our patients. And, you know, if this is a step towards it, that's very, very important. But there are a crucial proportion of people who we cannot engage in treatment. We cannot, you know, manage to keep people coming. And some people who won't go on to oral treatment. And those people are, you know, the elusive sort of 3% who are disengaged and people who are not undetectable. And they drive the majority of admissions to hospital, and they drive the majority of transmission. You know, people that are not diagnosed and not on treatment. So if we are really aiming for the UNAIDS target of elimination for 2030, we need to be able to find treatments that are not hard to take. You know, and our treatments, we have to accept, even a single daily pill is hard for some people to accept and hard for some people to take. And, you know, the health system has to accept that there are some people who can't do that.
Yeah. It's about providing options for different people, mm-hmm. you know, different options will suit different patients. Mm. Yeah. So coming back to the idea of long-acting treatment, are there any potential drawbacks to increasing the time between doses of a treatment? Would say, I mean, an injection of antiretroviral therapy every 6 months or every year even be desirable?
Yeah. So this is a really interesting question because we don't know the answer until it happens. I mean, COVID has shone a light on so many things, One of the things it's shone a light on is how we monitor patients and telemedicine, because our patients with HIV are at an increased risk of severe disease, hospitalization, and death from COVID, particularly people who've been immunosuppressed in the past. So for that reason, we've been cautious and we've been trying not to bring people into hospital for monitoring and blood tests when they're stable. So in most parts of the world, we haven't been seeing people very frequently, you know, and some people haven't had bloods for monitoring, and nonetheless, they are okay. So they're doing okay. So what we've learned is that potentially we may not need to monitor as frequently. So in some ways, this gives confidence around a six-monthly or an annual treatment for some people. Now, I say that for some, if it hasn't been a disaster, I think for some people it has been a disaster and some people have disengaged. And I think that it's really important to understand what are the reasons behind that and what would have stopped that, and would further investment in seeing people monthly during this period of time have kept people going? You know, is it the relationship with the clinic that keeps people going? And when you take that away, what happens to certain people? You know, and we are actually doing research around the effects of COVID, this disruptive change of COVID, to try and understand you know, all of to try and tease these issues out. So I think I can speculate, and my speculation would be that for some people, 6 monthly or annual treatment would be very, very desirable and advantageous. And for some people, they might fall off the wagon. And we would need to be very careful to try and learn to understand who these people are and how to identify them, how to monitor and how to bring people back, and how to develop safety nets and safeguards to treat people safely and give people what they need and what they want.
You mentioned that in Canada, they're already giving cabotegravir, they're sort of using it to treat patients. And it's great that that's now an option there. You're based in the UK.
Yep.
And your patients are in the UK. When do you think you would be able to start offering long-acting therapy to a substantial number of patients with HIV here in the UK?
It's been approved. So it received EMEA, European Medical Authorization, last year. Yeah. And that automatically means MHRA, so UK approval. It's a multi-step process. So firstly, it needs to be approved. So it has been approved by the regulator. The next step is to have a cost effectiveness analysis by NICE. And my understanding is that this is a process which is happening in various stages. Once that happens, then it has to go through, that NICE assessment has to go through to the commissioners, who have to try and assess in terms of the cost implications for the NHS. So it's a multi-step process. And I am hoping, fingers crossed, that by 2022, we might be able to prescribe it. If it's earlier than that, that would be wonderful, but hard to know. And I think the disruptive change of COVID, it's hard to really know, but I'm really hopeful that by next year, we'll be prescribing it.
Great. Well, it sounds like that's something that you're looking forward to be able to offer patients.
Absolutely. And I think finally, it's really important that this is offered not just to white gay men, but it's something which is actually accessible to all of our patients. And it's really important that, you know, ViiV continue to collect data, opportunistic data on pregnancies and outcomes for women from the PrEP program when pregnancies arrive, and from the treatment program. And it's really important that this is done. And I would say it's important to, you know, as we have more data to do studies in pregnant women, to make sure that there are studies in children. They are doing a study in children already, which is great to know, and to make sure that underserved groups are studied. Importantly, there is a study going on from the ACTG group, which is looking at people who are very poorly adherent to treatment, because these are the people we really want to give the drug to.
Yeah.
We don't know what will happen, because all the people who went into the trials, you know, were people who really adhered very well, who went undetectable within 20 weeks. So the people who were poor adherers were sort of excluded de facto. Yeah, so yeah. This study is going to read out. It's called the Latitude Study. So hopefully it will read out. They gave incentivized treatment for 24 weeks to try and get everyone undetectable, for those that, you know, people were not undetectable. And then after 24 weeks, they randomized to receive the injection or not. So I think that's going to give us more data on these very difficult to engage people, because we really need to know that. And the treatment needs to be for them as well. And I think as physicians, we all have to really advocate for this to not be a regimen for the rich, but to be a regimen for everybody, you know, in all parts of the world. And I think we're all responsible for that, and to say that, and to mean that. And that's why I do think I mention it last, but it's definitely not least.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think sort of various experiences in the HIV field and elsewhere throughout the years have taught us the importance of exploring treatments in every group that can benefit from it, and not ignoring any of the people who should have access to treatments in the study and development of drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's critically important.
Yeah, absolutely. Agree with you 100%. Okay, well, it's been really interesting speaking to you about the FLAIR study and about long-acting therapy. Such a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you so much for your work and for joining me today.
Well, it was such a pleasure, and you asked the most interesting and difficult questions, thought-provoking. I really enjoyed talking with you and answering them, and look forward to seeing the paper out in print.
Now, you might have noticed that we didn't talk about the potential for long-acting drugs for HIV prevention. That's a whole other subject area in itself. If you would like to read more about that, we've got a lot of content published in past issues of the journal, and I recommend starting with the review by Coelho and colleagues called Prevention 2.0, which was published back in November of 2019. And now, I'd just like to reiterate my thanks to Chloe for joining us today, and to you for listening. Do join us next time when we'll continue the conversation.